طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning we will be going directly to our featured presentation because it will fill the entire time that we have for This Week in Palestine. It is an interview I conducted with Dr. Bill Slaughter, a Cambridge psychiatrist affiliated with a Harvard Medical School, who was a frequent traveler to the West Bank and Gaza. I met Bill on his first trip to Palestine in 2008. We were both attending a mental health conference in Ramallah that was actually originally scheduled to be held in Gaza, but the Israeli military would not allow participants to enter Gaza, and so the conference was held in Ramallah with participation by Gazans held via the internet. The closest any of us got to Gaza was the Erez Gate on the border of Israel, where we all went to protest our exclusion from entering Gaza. Subsequently, Dr. Slaughter returns to the West Bank and Gaza almost every year, and is scheduled to return for his next visit this coming March of 2014. I sat down with Bill to discuss his commitment to the Palestinian struggle, and to get an idea about how he relates to the Palestinian population, both as an activist and as a physician whose skills as a psychiatrist are so welcomed and so needed by this population of people living under an oppressive occupation. Here is my interview with Dr. Bill Slaughter of the Harvard Medical School. Bill, you were a psychiatrist affiliated with the Harvard Medical School who was traveled to Palestine and Israel, going several times to the West Bank and Gaza. How did you first come to travel to Palestine, and why do you continue to go back? What's your affection with this part of the world?
That's exactly the right word. I had a two-part start. One was in the 70s when I studied Arabic because I thought the script looked beautiful. That hooked me up with a Habibati Filistinia, Palestinian girlfriend at the time, studied in Cairo at the American University there in the 70s. So I had kind of deep personal and love-beauty relationship to the area. In the 70s, most Arabic teachers were refugees either from Assad's dad or from Palestine. So I had a lot of refugee teachers and learned a lot about the Middle East then. I didn't use it, unfortunately, and it lay dormant in me, my connection with the Middle East and al-Lughat al-Arabiya, the Arabic language, until 9/11 attacks, when so many people in the U.S. were struggling with what can I contribute, what can I do, you know, with the clash of civilizations and such. So for me, my heart went to Palestine, and that's really the last 10, 12 years I've been focusing on that. And then starting to go back, you and I met in 2008.
That's right. We went. We were over there together.
I've just been really lucky to go back several times since then. Part of what I've tried to do is think of all Palestinians. So I've spent some time in 1948 Palestine, also known as Israel, West Bank, Gaza, and then also really made an effort to get to Lebanon and Jordan. I haven't been to Syria yet. But, you know, half the Palestinians are just outside Palestine, just waiting in the camps. So I've made an effort to get there, too, with my wonderful friend Ahmed Taha here in Cambridge, Palestinian from who grew up in some of the camps in Lebanon. So I've had some good guidance there.
Yeah. Kathy and I went to Lebanon in 2004 and Syria both.
And Syria also.
With Elaine Agopian and a group of folks from Boston area. We spent a week in the camps in Lebanon and a week in Syria. An amazing trip, particularly now with what's happening in Syria.
People are starving in Yarmouk camp now in Damascus.
It's unbelievable what's going on.
Yeah.
When you go over, what do you do? How do you structure yourself? Do you have a goal each time for going back?
So an overall goal is how to take information from there, since I'm lucky enough to be able to get there, and how to translate it into social change here in the U.S. So I do have a book project going now. Been bringing that along to, kind of a general introduction to the area for general U.S. public, since I think the general U.S. public is on the cusp of making some significant change thinking about Israel and Palestine. I want to bring that along. So I basically had a two-pronged time over in the area there. One is kind of focused on healthcare as a physician, thinking about that, learning more about conditions there, doing some trainings with trauma specifically, and also just about root causes, so about Palestinian return, root human rights, how to really fundamentally get at things. So most of what I've done in the short visits I have, I usually have between 10 days and 2 weeks when I'm able to go. A lot of what I've done is just visit a lot of different groups, try to get in two or three a day. And so I've been able to learn a lot about different groups on the Palestinian side, on the Jewish side in 48 Palestine and so on, and other groups. So, yeah.
So you're traveling through the West Bank, but also into Israel.
Absolutely, yeah. I think of Israel, Palestine. I know, each of those words has different connotations for different groups. I basically think of old Mandate Palestine from the Mediterranean to the Jordan as kind of Israel, Palestine. Mm-hmm. With the settlements on the West Bank, it's just so convoluted with, about 20% or so of so-called Israeli citizens being Palestinians. Things are just so mixed that there are lumpers and splitters, we said, at med school. There are people who like to see the nth detail of different kinds of shades of gray. So there are, of course, different legal statuses for different people here and there and all that kind of stuff. But overall, I tend to think of it as Palestine-Israel or Israel-Palestine, that whole area.
Right, and about 20% of the Israeli population is Palestinian Arab.
Yeah.
And they have a unique set of issues and problems, and so you are getting into those communities as well?
So I've not been to Israeli settlements on the West Bank. I almost did last time. I've been particularly heartened to learn of settlers, the Eretz Shalom group, who in the Etzion block down by Bethlehem, who are starting to try to decrease the extreme tension between most settlers and Palestinians by doing community outreach and stuff like that. I wasn't able to meet with them. I ran out of time, basically. And also within 48 Palestine, also known as Israel, some of the ultra-Orthodox thinking about how to work together with some of the Palestinians to preserve some of the old rundown mosques and places that have been destroyed. That's been particularly exciting to see the groups of settlers and ultra-Orthodox, who are sometimes seen as particularly not interested in accommodations and that, to see some of the groups there starting to make some change. So I'd like to spend more time with those groups as well.
How do you get into those communities? Those are pretty insulated and isolated communities and very suspicious of people that come in very often.
Yeah, I do think, I don't know ever the answer to that, exactly the right way to go, so I just keep making contacts and asking around and saying who I am and asking, and some things take relationship building over a few trips and things like that, but some things happen quickly. It's hard to say, yeah.
Now, as a psychiatrist and a physician, going into the West Bank and Gaza, occupied by Israel, suffering under checkpoints and separation walls, communities cut off from each other, mm-hmm. a population cut off from their fields, traumatized young people. As a psychiatrist, what What are some of the sort of unique conditions you find in talking with the young people there, or talking with any of the population, in terms of the problems that they have living under occupation or under the climate of war?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I see the whole region as stressed, as traumatized. And there are different dynamics in different communities there. And certainly, you know, in Syria now, in Western Iraq, there's huge trauma there going on as well. So I focus kind of on the Israel-Palestine area, including Palestinians outside of Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and so on. It depends on the specific community there. Each group in each compartment, I call them, with Israel 48, Palestine being one compartment, Gaza being another, West Bank, Lebanon, Jordan, has their own dynamics of why they are worst off. And they're all right. They're all correct. They all have a very difficult situation. A broad framing way to think about it is, what are the particular extreme stressors that are very clearly there in different populations? And then what are the bright sides, the resiliences, and so on? Everything along that spectrum exists at the same time. Take Gaza, for instance. It's clear that, I don't know if you remember, the psychologist Maslow had the idea of a hierarchy of needs, with the most basic being things like air, water, shelter, and then you work your way up there, human interconnectedness, self-actualization, things like that. So take Gaza, for instance, at the very basic life-sustaining basis of Maslow's pyramid, there are things like poor access to water. You know, water is a very important thing. We are, what, 95% water, that kind of thing. And so that's a huge issue. The sewage treatment, lack of that creates just infection through Gaza in different areas. There's physical stunting of children. About 30% of the kids in the most populated northern part of Gaza by Jabalia and refugee camp Beit Hanun up there, about 30% in a recent study were just physically stunted. Their bodies don't have enough nutrition. So there's that level of things. And certainly, you know, the PTSD construct, post-traumatic stress disorder, is poo-pooed in Gaza because it's ongoing. Yeah. It's ongoing. It's only the question of, do we have high level of attacks going on now, or are we at a lull where we're only dealing with not enough water and food? That's the least traumatized period in Gaza now. So the ongoing stress disorder is always there. And that's true regionally as well. It really is. That's just the particularly hardest hit area there, so to speak. On the other hand, you know, more of the psychological studies in now, in the last 10 years or so, are looking at resilience. In the face of all these things, how are people dealing with that? How do they cope? You know, there's the religious aspects that have become more predominant since the, you know, initial Israeli support of Hamas and so on, with that movement having grown since, what was that, 1988 or something like that. The spiritual life of people, some outside of Islam, certainly the Christian minority and other more secular approaches. There's a meditation community in Gaza and so on that's really exciting. You know, how is resilience there? How has it grown? It's really neat to see that as well. So part of what always is amazing to me, I don't know how it was for you when you were there, is just to see the juxtaposition of really bad conditions, a lot of psychological stress and so on, and then people in the midst of that finding ways to cope as best they can.
So. Now, when you go over, do you relate to other psychiatrists? Do you talk to people in clinics or various centers and talk to them about the population that they're treating? Yeah. Do they involve you in any way with...
Yeah. It really depends. I don't have much Arabic. I wish I did. Mm-hmm. So I make a point of always visiting at least healthcare clinics. So there's a large, and those are on different levels. So the big governmental ones that by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, and then UNRWA, the United Nations, in all the different compartments or fields there, except for 48 Palestine, also known as Israel. So I visit the clinics at least to get a glimpse of what's going on and talk at least with the administrators about what their pressures are. And they're always underfunded. There are different issues. There's a lot of good international support, both in funding big clinics and also small specialty organizations, the Médecins Sans Frontières, the medical aid from Palestine in the UK, and the Native Arab, indigenous Arab and Palestinian help as well. I've been most happy when I'm able to interact with colleagues and kind of doing trainings, and they're usually two-way, you know, with me learning from them and me giving some perspectives that I have as well. I've most been able to do a two-way exchange like that, other than just visiting clinics briefly in that, in Gaza. And in fact, what we focused on there, last time I was there in March 2013, coming up on a year now, might have another trip this March, was specifically about trauma, ongoing nightmare, recurrent nightmare kind of trauma, and what to do with that. Okay, they were particularly interested in that. So what we focused on was the current most evidence-based treatment for ongoing traumatic nightmare, recurrent nightmares, and then applications in Gaza for that. And they have plenty of nightmares there. So, and they actually, it was interesting to see that the techniques that the psychologists developed there, just in their own way of working day-to-day with people, were very similar to the current best evidence techniques that have been developed in the West. So it's like a natural confluence.
So you were able to get into Gaza a year ago?
Yeah. And I have another permit now, so hoping to use that this March as well.
What is that process like? I mean, when you want to go into Gaza, what do you have to do?
Yeah, so there's basically, you could say, three routes. One is through Israel, also known as 1948 Palestine, at the Eretz crossing. One is through Rafah, through Egypt. And the other is just any other way, through flotillas from Greece and things like that. So for me, it comes down practically not having time to participate in a flotilla through the Eretz part of Israel or through Egypt. Egypt now has become more dangerous than the Sinai and so on, so I've not gone that way. So for me, it boils down to Israel. You need two permits. One is from the Israelis, and one is on the Palestinian government side, permit to be in Gaza from the Palestinian government there. So it's basically getting an international organization in Gaza to apply to the Israelis. So I've used the World Health Organization, and that's worked out a couple of times. And then you have to apply through a healthcare organization to the Gaza government, the Gaza-Palestinian government as well.
I see. And so when you went into Gaza, did some of us know about the work of the Gaza Mental Health Center and Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, who's just recently died. I met him first, I guess, was in 2001. Yeah. And then subsequently he came here. I never got back to Gaza. I was never able to get back into Gaza since then. But he's come several times and so got to meet him. But tell us about your relationship with that center and the kind of work that he's doing, the kind of work that is being done at the Gaza Mental Health Center.
Yeah. So I mostly interact through the prism of a group that we have here in the U.S., the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, that was set up in 2001 by Nancy Murray and Don McGinnis and Elaine Hadopian. Right. Thanks very much to all of them for their foresight and compassion in founding, setting up that organization, where we take donations from inside the U.S. and give them to mental health organizations in the Strip. And Iyad El-Sarraj's Gaza Mental Health Program has been the primary recipient of that over the, I guess, a dozen years now that's been going. Just made no donations now at the end of 2013, along with some other grassroots and NGO level organizations there too. So, it's been a combination of kind of, you know, trying to pass money to them for their clinical services in the Strip, and also that is where I did do some of the trainings with some of the trainees they had and some of the staff they had, as well as with the Red Crescent, which is the Red Cross equivalent in the Muslim world, of course, is the Red Crescent. So interactions with their staff, learning from them and doing some training, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we do support through the Gaza Mental Health Foundation here, and you can Google that if you want, if anybody wants to support mental health services in the Strip through our organization. We have very low overhead and just pass through most of what we have. Another organization that we've studied are the women that we've funded are the Women's Empowerment Projects, of which there are three in different parts of the Strip, and then another one called New Horizons, Afak Jadida, which does community-based women's and kids-focused supports for really enrichment in after-school and during-school programs, and then in community centers. In some parts of conservative Muslim society, some of the women feel isolated in some ways, and having women's centers and so on, specifically for that gender, bringing people together and learning about parenting, about first aid for traumatized kids through moms, that kind of thing. It's really a way of extending services through community-based actions. So, yeah.
Very good. Now, when you come back, tell us about how you relate to your colleagues here, who must be interested in what you're doing there and what you're seeing. And how does it go in terms of trying to relate to them and trying to tell them what's going on and perhaps involve them?
Yeah. So I've not done a lot yet in, you know, medical, psychiatry, counseling circles to talk about Gaza. I've been so caught up with the Mental Health Foundation in trying to get this broad book project to reach all general American populations off the ground and get that going. One thing that I have done is try to work on social tensions here in the U.S. through working on healthcare initiatives in the metro area here that have to do with supporting Muslims having best healthcare. And that's been presenting some at the Malden Mosque with my friend Ahmed Taha, and also at the Roxbury Mosque, the Islamic Society of Boston and Cultural Center there. There's a health initiative going at that specific mosque, and also Greater Boston Muslim Health Initiative, where I do try to talk some about what's going on in Palestine and Gaza, but also just build ties with not just Palestinian or not just Arab, but Muslim healthcare providers and community here in general to try to kind of ease social relations here. Part of how I've been trying to use that recently is to find out specifically about a shadow or problematic area, which is substance abuse, which is a tremendous problem in Gaza, not so much in other parts of Palestine, but in Gaza and Egypt, and try to find out what best practices are in Arab and broader Muslim communities about dealing with substance abuse. It's a highly stigmatized issue in all cultures, including in different Muslim cultures. And so that's something that I hope to take back to Gaza. There are both medication treatments and also kind of interpersonal support treatments, similar to 12-step and that kind of thing, that are used in Muslim communities here and there. And I hope to take some of that back to Gaza, since they're wanting different treatment supports there around opiate dependence in particular.
Now, the Muslim community in this country faces unique stress, too, particularly since 9/11.
Absolutely.
And so in your work in the mosques and within that community, do you see this kind of stress played out? Do they talk about it? Talk about what's happening?
Yeah. Without Arabic or any other Muslim majority language, Somali, Urdu, Farsi, and so on, I've only sat in on some like kind of direct counseling events a few times. Of course, a lot of that happens in English as well, so yeah, it doesn't matter. But I'm not Muslim myself, and so I wrestle with what should my exact role be.
Right.
I've taken more of a kind of consultant, advisor board, you know, that kind of thing role, and tried to learn more myself. But yes, certainly, you know, we had the specific event here with the tragedy of the marathon bombings, and that sent ripples out through Muslim community, I think, worldwide to some extent, not to overemphasize the hub's role globally.
Yeah.
But in the U.S. too, you know, there were a couple attacks on Muslims here, thankfully. I wasn't in Boston during the 9/11 attacks. I was out in my home city of Seattle. Mm-hmm. But in talking to people here, they said, yeah, there were a couple attacks, one on a Palestinian physician in Malden, one on a Saudi guy in Boston itself. But the Muslim community, my understanding was, felt that the general tenor after the Marathon bombings was not as anti-Muslim as they felt more tension after the 9/11 attacks. It was neat to hear that, but still, yes, absolutely stressful. And you know, people taking the stance, you know, ISBCC, the Roxbury Mosque, and Imam Webb, there have been real leaders, in, you know, in saying Boston's strong, we're with the community. Want to help figure out what's been going on, you know, and deal with our concerns about being stigmatized and how to be good citizens and all that. And so we had had some counseling groups and outreach times, Friday after Friday prayer, community discussions and things like that that I think have been
yeah, well, it was horrendous following 9/11. Yeah. I mean, I was with the ACLU at the time, and there were Arab-Palestinian Muslim men simply disappeared.
Yeah.
Were disappeared.
Yeah.
Literally, that's the word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their lawyers didn't know where they were. Their families didn't know where they were. We were trying to find out where they were. We were meeting with the U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
We were meeting with and getting completely stonewalled.
Yeah.
They just disappeared. They were arrested. They were picked up. And we ultimately found out that a number of them were down in Fall River and began to find out. But, I mean, that went on here in this country. Not too many people know that or remember that, but they disappeared. They just were simply picked up.
I was studying for medical exams in Seattle through summer of 2001 at a test center, and developed a relationship with a Saudi physician who was studying at the same test center. He was kind enough to take me to the main mosque in Seattle, the Northgate Mosque, and so on. We developed our friendship over the months before the 9/11 attack. Just after the attack, he also just disappeared, and I was never able to find out what happened to him.
Yeah.
So the good news was in Seattle that the Northgate Mosque, the largest mosque there, in some ways comparable to the Roxbury Mosque here, SBCC, after the 9/11 attack, a neighborhood citizen group of non-Muslim neighbors surrounded the mosque to watch for attacks on the mosque and acted as a neighborhood watch in conjunction with the mosque community at Northgate to help protect against attacks.
Yeah, I remember after 9/11, that Sunday, I think it was on a Tuesday, the attack was on a Tuesday, and that Sunday, the mosque on Prospect Street here in Cambridge invited the community to come in.
Right.
They were just terrified,
right.
and invited the community to come in. And we went in, and you know, I stood up and said, I was with the ACLU, what can we do? What do you need right now?
Yeah.
And coming out of that, the request was that they wanted to sit down with law enforcement.
Yeah.
They were terrified about what was going on. They wanted protection, and they wanted... with the cooperation of the Attorney General then was Tom O'Reilly, the police commissioner was Paul Evans.
Yeah.
And I had a relationship with both of those, and I called them, and they put together a high-level meeting, pulled together law enforcement people, brought in the community, and we set up liaisons so that if they felt unprotected or they were frightened, they knew where to go, they knew who to call, and we got some wonderful cooperation, and that really brought the level of fear down.
Excellent.
A good bit, but those were trying times.
Yeah.
Those were just wild times.
Yeah.
Aye.
Good work.
So you're thinking about going back this March again.
Yeah, I have a permit to get from Israel, 1948 Palestine, into Gaza that expires in April. So it's always hard to get, so I want to use it while I have it.
Well, that's wonderful that you're able to get in.
Yeah.
There's just so many people that are not able to get in. But
you
say you're through the World Health Organization?
Yeah, that's the group that I've used from Gaza.
So your credentials as a doctor really... Or as a physician and psychiatrist, really?
I think that's part of it. You know, the Israelis are in a difficult position, obviously, after so many years of occupation. We use the word occupation both about Gaza and the West Bank and Palestine, but, you know, sometimes we can think about all of Israel-Palestine as occupied and, you know, how to think about things like that. But how difficult it is to be in the occupier position and to both have some degree of responsibility, well, to have full responsibility for what happens in throughout the area, but be concerned about protection and so on. So yeah, they let in some medical personnel, some human rights personnel and that kind of thing, while at the same time keeping Gaza as a big open-air prison. Mm-hmm. Those are odd dynamics. So how do we get out of this box overall as a culture is a basic underlying question.
One of the problems I find in traveling into Israel is what little the population, the Jewish population, knows about what's going on there. It is stunning.
Well, John, I want to say something about that. Again, using this idea of compartments in that area, Gaza as one, Israel or 48 Palestinians another, West Bank, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria. We Americans have a really special ability, which is our ability to move throughout those compartments. Now, it is true that sometimes there's danger in some of those compartments, and I have to be careful and have family tell me don't go and all that kind of thing. So you have to be careful, certainly. But I, like you, am amazed at people in different compartments asking me about the people in the compartment next door, 5 miles away. Yeah. Last time I was not in Gaza, but at an Israeli kibbutz just outside Gaza that experienced shelling and so on. They're asking me, hey, how are the folks doing just about 3 miles to the west over in Khan Yunis, over in Rafah? You know, what's going on with them there? We can see them, but we can't talk to them. And, you know, we like to get along better, that kind of thing. I was excited to visit a group of Israeli activists in that atavistic town of Sderot, which is always used for political purposes there. The Israeli Jews there who were working with Palestinians in Gaza on, you know, cross-border peace and security kind of ideas there. It's really heartening to see them. And to get so many questions by Jews and Palestinians in Israel about how are people doing over there? So we have a very special ability there sometimes to move across compartments that people there don't. So that's always really important. I'd like to say about another thing I did, on my last trip, which is in September, October of 2013, after that March Gaza trip, which was really focused on attending a conference in Tel Aviv about Palestinian return.
Yes.
Okay? By the Zohrot and other related organizations there. One way I think about Palestinian return, you know, Jewish return is so well known in the U.S., the right of return of all Jews worldwide to go back to Israel, the old state of Israel, in the narrow sense there. So what about the right of Palestinian return? Right of Palestinian return, of course, is anchored in international law, UN Resolution 194, and so on, but is so little known in the U.S., even though we have such an equal rights tradition in the U.S., regardless of religion, ethnicity, national background, and so on. So I've always been particularly interested in Palestinian return, which I think is the key to overall fundamental sea change towards social justice and peace in Palestine. The primarily Jewish, but some Palestinians involved organization, Zohrot, in Israel, Israel proper, if I can call it that, had a wonderful conference in September of 2013 that's online. If you go to zohrot.org, Z-O-C-H-R-O-T.org, URL, really bringing together Jewish and Palestinian organizations, the NGOs and grassroots organizations that are working on safe, peaceful return of Palestinians throughout Palestine. Of course, about 3/4 of Palestinians are refugees. 12 million Palestinians in the world. Mm-hmm. That's a huge issue that we just don't acknowledge enough in the U.S. And here were the Jewish and Palestinian groups working in quite a coordinated manner on everything from current return. There are groups during return, usually summer camps and so on demolished village sites, and also broader thinking about how can a Palestinian return happen in a peaceful, safe way that's acceptable and supported by all humans of all ethnicities who support human rights for all. So that's very exciting for me to see. And then to hook up with the specific groups there a little bit more to talk about.
Well, there's a good deal of work being done on that. There was a conference here at Boston University.
Yep.
I was amazed to hear urban planners and architects, people working with food production, with that are looking at this and saying, you know, this is possible.
Yeah.
There is space for it. There's room for it.
Yeah.
It will take planning and going to work on it. The other thing is, what a lot of people don't understand is that the right of return for Palestinians extends to the individual. Some people sort of think that this thing can somehow be...
Well, let's put it this way. Can somehow be given up by the Palestinian Authority? Can somehow be signed away by Abbas and Arafat and that clique that's doing the negotiation?
They think it's a bargaining chip.
Yeah, yeah.
And but it does. It extends to the individual, as it does in this country. The rights extend to the individual.
What a concept.
And it can't be bargained away.
Yeah.
And I think any Palestinian leader that tries to bargain it away, it will be all over.
It was interesting to hear, like, for example, one of the particularly activist camps, Dehesha camp by Bethlehem,
yes,
that's been just a leader for decades in, forthright, proactive activism, barred Arafat, the negotiator, from the camp when he wanted to come visit, I guess, a couple years ago, just because of the... fear of, presenting to the West the idea that Palestinian right of return can be signed away. For me, the essential problem there is in the West, because of so many cultural and language and political issues, it's hard to access directly in a loud, broad way within American society what Palestinians in general are saying and thinking. So we get this perception through the Palestinian Authority and so on that where Abbas is talking about not going home, not exercising, he personally giving up his personal right of return to Safad in the Galilee where he was from, and that he is giving that up. Okay, how does that translate to the U.S. and European public thinking that he has authority to do that for all Palestinians?
Right.
He can certainly sign some wording, he can sign that, but as you point out, that doesn't cover all 12 million Palestinians, probably about 8 million of which who are refugees. So there's this perception in the West that perhaps it can be given up. The Palestinians, their Arab and broader Muslim brethren and sistren, is that a word, throughout the world, know that that's not true, and it will not happen, will not happen. And so there's that mismatch of perceptions. And so that's just such a huge mismatch that I think needs to be brought out more for the American public, that what the PA signs away, if they do, doesn't have any purchase with the 8 million Palestinian refugees.
Nor the state of the law. You don't change the law. You don't. So the international law, the right exists regardless of what they do. The right continues to exist. They can't simply do that.
Yeah, I think it's such a challenge about how the big forces, the U.S., supporters of the State of Israel as it's currently constituted, would like to remake international law. And, there's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And sometimes that prevails for a while.
Yes.
So I think it's really dangerous. I want to say one other thing. The State of Israel as it currently exists, I say, one of the most exciting things about that I've experienced in visiting Palestinians everywhere, in whatever compartments they may be, inside Palestine currently or immediately outside, is this the being pushed into the sea fear that a lot of the strong rightist Zionist groups bring up has never, ever been brought up. And when I ask Palestinians about that, they make a point of always saying, our vision of Palestine, and this includes, relatively conservative, Muslim Palestinians as well as more secular folks in that, our vision of Palestine always, always, always is multi-ethnicity, as it has been for thousands of years. Yes, the current constitution of the State of Israel, since it's ethnicity privilege based, yes, we take exception with that, and we don't know how that will go with broad Palestinian right of return. But that doesn't mean that we have animosity towards Jews individually or towards Judaism as a brother-sister religion, as an Abrahamic monotheistic religion. course. So a lot of times that fear in the U.S. of Israel being pushed into the sea, you know, there's a difference between the state of Israel as it's been constituted since 48, you know, based on ethnic privilege on the one hand, versus acceptance of Jewish people. And it's especially exciting for me to see people who are Jewish in the compartments in the area there outside of Israel, so in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Gaza, and the West Bank, welcomed as helpers who were respectful of rights of all, helping in healthcare organizations, helping in rights and activist organizations. I had particular fun the last time on the West Bank for one afternoon, riding with some Jewish activists from Jerusalem in an old beat-up pickup truck down to the Hebron, South Hebron Hills, south of Hebron, just still within the West Bank, but just north of the Green Line there, in the Susia, Yatta area.
Tough area.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Really hotbed area, where the Jewish activists from Jerusalem escorted school kids, Palestinian school kids, past a settlement there, where the settlers had tried to stop school kids from getting to and from school. So here were the Jewish activists from Jerusalem coming down and walking with the kids just by the settlement so they wouldn't be stoned by the settlers who'd attacked the kids before with stones and baseball bats and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thing cross-culturally, just basic human rights and caring for each other that I see as tremendously powerful in the area there. And the Palestinians, of course, quite welcoming. Why are we going to throw the damn Jews into the sea if they're helping us? And there's the potential for everyone to go through radical changes like that. Not dissimilar to changes in the U.S., where we had slavery throughout the U.S., including Massachusetts, and where there's been a sea change over years, moving from fundamentally race-based, ethnic privilege stances here in the U.S. to a broader human rights view of equality for everyone. Now, we have lingering effects and, you know, insidious levels of racism still, so it doesn't happen overnight or in one generation. But I think we have a lot to teach from the U.S. here about how to move from ethnic privilege to rights for all. I think we can help people in Israel-Palestine make that transition here. We've been through it as a culture. We're still going through it, but we've made major strides.
Yeah. It's difficult because I've always seen that, talking about, you know, driving the Jews into the sea as a real ruse. I mean, we're talking about the fifth largest military power here. And who's pushing who? Who's taking whose land?
Yeah.
I mean, the Jews are not being pushed into the sea, but the Palestinians are being pushed into the desert, and their land is being taken. And so when we hear these negotiations talking about some of these, quote, security issues, it's if it wasn't so serious, it would be laughable.
Yeah.
And so I see that mostly as a ruse, as a myth that we have to, we really have to puncture in this country. We really have to deal with that.
Yeah. But I do think, you know, so as an American who's not Jewish, who's not Muslim, I'm not Arab, you know, I have direct personal first degree family relations with people who are Jewish and have been extremely close to Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and secular folks. You know, I do think we have to find ways in the U.S. to think about the main psychologies, plural, different worldviews of populations in the U.S. and how to help our U.S. countrymen go through changes, including those who have strong ethnic privilege biases, how to move beyond those stances, you know, how to move beyond those. And I think we've done a lot as a culture here since slavery times to make some changes. And there are ways that we can push change in Israel-Palestine so it doesn't have to take as long as it's taken in the U.S.
Hopefully. Bill, we've run out of time. We've barely scratched the surface here. I hope we can do this again. I would love to have you back, particularly when you maybe come back
after
March and continue this. Your work is incredibly valuable in your insights. So thank you very much, and we'll do it again.
Toda roba, shukran jazilan. Thank you very much, John. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Take care.
That was an interview with Dr. Bill Slaughter of the Harvard Medical School, a frequent visitor to the West Bank and Gaza. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.